From Hook and Bullet to Policy and Science, we're here to discuss and dissect all matters of importance to Montana's rugged landscape and the people and wildlife that call it home. This is Montana Untamed. Two 200 years ago, grizzly bears ruled the Montana landscape. Today, people have taken that throne and relegated the animal to a fraction of its former range. But the bears, backed by legal protection and decades of recovery effort, have begun reasserting themselves, in some cases wandering through areas they haven't been spotted in for decades. The slow expansion has led to an increase in bear conflicts that run the gamut in severity. Trash can rummages, chicken coop break-ins, attacks on large livestock, fatal human maulings. And as both human and bear populations continue to swell, experts say the number of conflicts will grow as well. A year ago, a fatal grizzly mauling captured local and national headlines, and now it's back. With me today is Josh Murdoch, outdoors and natural resources reporter at the Missoulian newspaper, and Rob Chaney, editor of the Missoulian newspaper. Josh, tell us about this mauling. What happened?
So last summer, early in the morning on July 6, 2021, a 400-pound grizzly bear fatally mauled a woman who was camping in Evando, which is in the Blackfoot Valley, just a little bit west of Lincoln and a little bit further west of Helena, Montana. And the woman was 65-year-old from Chico, California, named Leah Logan. And she and her sister and their friend were riding their bike along the Continental Divide from Canada, the U.S.-Canada border, all the way down to Mexico. And it's believed that the bear was attracted to her tent specifically by some food scents that were in the tent and right nearby. And that's fairly normal. What was a little bit unusual about this tack that really raised eyebrows was that it happened right in the center of a small town, not necessarily where people would expect to be at high risk for a grizzly attack. And then the bear really seemed to go after her rather than just killing her in the process of trying to get food in the tent. And three days later, wildlife managers did track down the bear and they killed the bear.
So as you said, that was a year ago. Why is it important now? Why is it coming back up in the news?
Right. Yeah. So that happened last summer, not this July 6th. And what happened recently was that at the end of June this year, just last month, the Interagency Grizzly Bear Committee, which includes people from state, federal, and tribal wildlife and land managers, they released, or their Board of Review released, a 26-page final report about the attack. So the report broke down in really, really fine detail exactly what happened before, during, and after the attack. It talked about exactly what victims, or excuse me, exactly what injuries the victims sustained. It had a lot of information on the bear from the autopsy on the bear, and it had a lot of recommendations on how something like that could possibly be prevented in the future. So it was a little bit of a learning experience towards the conclusion of the document too.
So were there any details about the event and the mauling that we learned from the report that we didn't already know?
So the general chronology that was contained in the report was about the same as what a lot of regional and national news organizations had reported at the time. Some of the big things were a little bit more detail on exactly how much the bear weighed and exactly what they are pretty sure the bear was up to in the hours before the attack, and then what they think it did over the course of the next 3 days before they ultimately killed it.
Okay, so, and you said, you know, we have a 400-pound grizzly bear. Do we know anything more about this particular grizzly bear, about its life and about its condition at the time of the mauling?
Yeah, so they said that it seemed like it was relatively healthy. It was a little bit underweight, but it wasn't anything that they said they wouldn't expect for early summer in that area. They think it was somewhere between 4 and 7 years old. And they didn't have much of a profile for this individual grizzly. It wasn't a tracked bear. Each of its parents, they realized, had been tracked years earlier. But this one wasn't really on their radar. Okay. They don't think it had been in or around the town much until it wandered into town late night on the 5th and first popped up on some security cameras. And that was just a few hours before the attack.
So let's go back to the report, and you said that there were some recommendations outlined by the Interagency Grizzly Bear Committee. What were some of those recommendations?
Yeah, so this Border Review report, they had recommendations for all different groups. They even made recommendations for the agencies that responded to this incident, which the members of the Border Review and the committee are part of. So they were even looking at their own actions and how they could have done better. Some of the big things for people who are recreating in grizzly country, which would include Leah Loken and her friends, was to keep all food and smellable items away from tents and camping areas, you know, store food properly in a bear container or hang it up or put it in a building or a car, and make sure you cook and keep food more than 100 feet away from tents. One of the big pieces of advice that they stressed for people camping in grizzly territory is that if a bear comes by your campsite and you ward it off, don't stay in the campsite that night. Like, it's time for you to leave too. And it also said for people to assume that they can encounter a grizzly anywhere across Western Montana, even if they're not in an area like Glacier or Yellowstone National Park that's really known for bears.
Right.
And then they also had recommendations for towns and communities and land managers that included being a bit more comprehensive about posting signage that educates people about the fact that they're in grizzly territory, how to stay safe. And they wanted those institutions to actually provide resources to people to be able to do that. You know, more provisions of bear boxes or hard-sided buildings in which to store food. Don't just tell people, here's what you need to do. Really enable them to do it and make sure it's more widespread. And then for anybody organizing an event on public lands, they wanted to see safe bear practices and education be required as part of any event in a special use permit for public lands. So making sure that events are required to let people know and help them follow these practices.
So to me, it sounds like a lot of these recommendations are what we've known, you know, it's kind of the blueprint for safe behavior in bear territory. And it sounds to me like maybe the only, you know, new things to come out of this are those recommendations towards organizers and agencies. Is that correct? Were there any other revelations from this report about how recreationalists can stay safe in bear country?
So, yeah, I mean, what you mentioned about incorporating this into, you know, a possible, you know, use permit for some sort of formal organized event, that was something that, at least to me, sounded new or a little bit beyond what previously is discussed with bear education, where it's very individual. And then the other thing was just really that they mentioned that you need to be thinking about grizzly bears, whether or not you're in Glacier National Park or whether or not you're in Yellowstone National Park. If you're in Butte, you should be thinking there could be a grizzly bear here and you should take those steps. They really stress that, like, if you're in Western Montana, consider yourself in grizzly territory, even if you're not in a place like one of those national parks or surrounding areas that already kind of hammers home, like, hey, there's grizzlies here. So that was another thing that I thought was interesting about that recommendation.
So the idea being is if you're recreating anywhere in Western Montana, although the formal or the previous kind of common knowledge was your proximity to Yellowstone and your proximity to Glacier dictated whether you were in grizzly bear habitat. But the idea being in the recommendation that they're providing is, hey, anytime you're in Western Montana, no matter what your distance or proximity to, you know, these two epicenters, ecosystem epicenters, you are in grizzly bear habitat.
Yeah, that was my takeaway from that recommendation. Rob has been following this issue for a lot longer than I have, so I think he can speak a little more to how, you know, how much that has or hasn't been stressed in the past.
This brings up a problem that a lot of folks have, I think, in dealing with the change in grizzly bear numbers and grizzly bear prevalence all over the Rocky Mountains, is that for the last four decades of grizzly bear recovery, we've had this idea, or we've propagated this idea, that grizzly bears live in recovery zones. the Northern Continental Divide ecosystem that mm-hmm. goes from Glacier Park down to where this killing occurred was a recovery zone. The Greater Yellowstone area is a recovery zone. And we get this impression that there are boundaries and those are sort of terrariums where grizzly bears live. And there's something right. that keeps them inside. That is biologically and actually historically false. There is nothing right. that keeps those bears in those areas or prevents them from coming out of those areas. And the contrary, there's all kinds of reasons for bears to leave those areas and go explore new country. So when people come into Montana, especially folks who are doing something like these cross-country bike tours, where you're traveling in Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado that do not have grizzly bears, and then you assume that you cross the border into Montana and things change. Those borders are human conceptions. The bears have no interest, respect, or observation of them. And the idea that because you're on one side of a line on a map or another, that your behavior should change or that a bear's behavior should change is just a problematic position to put yourself in from that first step.
Right. So, Josh, would any of these recommendations have helped Leah Loken?
It's hard to say, you know, going back, you know, what could or would have changed what happened on July 6th. But there's definitely some things that are outlined in these recommendations that Loken and some of the other people camping there didn't do. She did have food in her tent and in bags on her bike that was only about 10 feet away. So there was a lot of food in and around her tent. And this grizzly actually approached her tent and the tent of a couple camped right next to her about an hour before the fatal attack. And Loken and the campers got out of their tents. They shouted at the bear. They warded the bear off. It went away. She then took the food that was in her tent out of the tent. She put it in a building that was nearby. But there was still food in the bags on her bike. And she had, according to the report, she had reused some bags that previously contained blueberries. She used those bags to store other things. And those remained in her tent. But they still smelled like blueberries, even when first responders got there. And so there was still a lot of food smell in and around her tent. And after they first warded off the grizzly, all the campers got back into their tents. And, you know, who knows if she or they would have acted differently had they been operating under more of an assumption that in the center of this small town, they were still in grizzly country.
So, Josh, in digging deeper into that report, did it address the basic problem that we are food? We are giant sacks of meat wrapped up in a sleeping bag in a tent when we are sleeping somewhere. And the idea that a bear might, you know, just hold us down while it went for the Snickers bar in our pocket seems a little bit facetious on its face. Does the report have anything to say about whether she was the food or she just happened to be killed in the act of a bear having some sort of a radical reaction to her fighting back?
So that's kind of one big question mark that I have as I think about this report. It did address that, but it didn't come to any conclusions. It noted two things that are specific to what you just brought up. One of which is that the bear did not feed on her. In the course of her being attacked, the couple who was camped in the tent right next to her, they jump out of their tent again. I believe one of them believes that they deployed bear spray. It's unclear where that canister ended up. Might have been in the hotel. But they believe they deployed bear spray in all that chaos. They shouted at the bear. The bear did leave again for a final time and didn't come back. But the damage was already done. But, you know, even though it didn't feed on Loken, it didn't appear to be going, or at least not anymore, going after the food in her tent. It had dragged her out of her tent and halfway out of her sleeping bag, and it was jumping up and down on her head and her chest. It was just going after her. And that was what the Interagency Grizzly Bear Committee called a predatory response that was from the bear directed at Loken, not just, like you said, it wasn't just ripping her out of the tent to get the food. It seemed to, at some point, shift to going after her. But beyond that, the Board of Review said that they couldn't speculate on why or when or for what reason the bear had that predatory response. They said they couldn't know what triggered it. Was it emotion by Loken? Was it something else? When was that predatory response triggered? They just said they couldn't know.
Yeah, you know, that poses the question that, you know, it sounds like the report didn't obviously come to a conclusion, but, you know, there's, you think about, you know, was the bear coming for the food and she got in the way and that's why the bear engaged with her and not the food? You know, the other campers scared the bear away, so we don't really know if the bear was, you know, eventually going to, you know, the food was the target. And for that matter, the other campers scared the bear away, so we don't really know if the bear would have fed on Leah. And so, you know, I think it just goes to show that even though there is this report, there's still a lot of questions going on about, you know, what bear behavior is happening. And unfortunately, we can't get into their minds and know exactly what they're thinking. Josh, will you tell me what was the route that brought Loken and these others to Ovando that night?
Yeah, so they, along with thousands of other people each summer, were riding the Great Divide mountain bike route, and that was mapped out about 20 years ago, actually by an organization based here in Missoula, the Adventure Cycling Association. And usually ACA mainly makes road-based routes, but the Great Divide route is mostly trails and dirt roads that follows the general path of the Continental Divide from the southern region of British Columbia all the way down to the US-Mexico border. And from where this route starts in British Columbia all the way to about Riverton, Wyoming, on the west side of the Wind River Range, you're in or very near grizzly country for that entire time, for hundreds of miles at the start of this route. And thousands of riders each year attempt to ride this route. And each year, starting in early June, there's actually a race called Tour Divide that generally follows this Great Divide route. And about 150 people do that race each year. And just like when you're riding this route casually for fun, everybody in the race is self-supported the entire time. The course record for that race is about 2 weeks, but most people in the race and on this route take a month or longer.
And by self-supported, you mean they are carrying all of their provisions and the equipment necessary for the trip, correct?
Correct. So generally this sport, whether it's competitive or you're doing it for fun, is called bike packing, just a take on backpacking. And it's a lot of the same tenets, except the bags go on your bike instead of your back.
Okay. And so when people do the race, are they warned about grizzlies and, like you said, the hundreds of miles of grizzly territory that they'll be riding and sleeping in?
Yeah. So the interesting thing about Tour Divide, and for that matter, a slew of other bikepacking races and the activity of bikepacking in general, whether you're in a race or not, is that it's really intentionally a decentralized grassroots affair. There's like Tour Divide isn't incorporated. There's not a race organization. There's not permit. There's not even an entry fee for participants. There's no prizes. There's nobody waiting at the finish line. When you're done, you're done. The whole thing just comes together online, informally, in forums about the race. And these days, it all happens in Facebook groups. The closest thing to any sort of structure it has is simply that there's a former participant, Matthew Lee, who's a professional mountain bike racer and lives in North Carolina. And he did the first 7 editions. And since then, he just picks a start date so that everybody has a standard start date. He posts it online. He makes sure that a GPS route is standard and available online for people to download. And he and a business partner operate a site called trackleaders.com that people can sign up so that their little dot can appear on the map in Tour Divide online. And they do that for Tour Divide and a bunch of other races. But he's not the organizer of the race, and there is no organizer of the race. He doesn't go to the start line or anything. Riders just take this route on unsupported, as if they were a hiker going on the Pacific Crest Trail or the Appalachian Trail. It's the same kind of thing. And the race is simply that 150 of those riders all agree we're going to start at the same time, and we're going to carry a GPS tracker so that people can see us. So there's not any formal organization for riders to get educated.
This brings up a really interesting other Board of Review grizzly fatality report from a few years back when a law enforcement officer named Brad Treat was riding his bike on a trail in the Coram area on the west side of Glacier Park and collided with a grizzly bear. And the grizzly killed him and then vanished. It was considered a tragic accident. There wasn't anything predatory or otherwise. They just came around a corner, had no chance to stop, and the bear killed him and left. That Board of Review report got deep into the characteristics of bike riding in grizzly country. And the two things that came out very loud and clear were that bikes aren't loud and they are fast. So the chances that you will surprise a bear in a place where you don't have any opportunity to react are considerably higher when you're on a bicycle than when you are walking as a backpacker or when you're riding in a car as a general tourist. And that Board of Review report pointed directly at bicycling in grizzly country as a increased risk factor for recreational activity out there. As we're seeing more and more of these bikepacking opportunities developing in more and more what are sometimes now called side country, logging roads that, you know, are developed, but they're way out of sight of anything. They're way out of range of any quick help. And you're zooming along at, you know, 3 to 10 times faster than what a person on foot can do. You're putting yourself at a considerably higher risk of colliding with a bear and having a really tragic result.
So with that in mind, Josh, are these, the bikepacking community, are they pretty savvy about bear safety? You know, how do they learn about being safe in bear country?
Yeah, so I think luckily most mountain bikers who live in these regions, and particularly most bikepackers, they do due diligence and they know what they're getting into out here. I've talked to a lot of bikepackers specifically in reporting this story. And also I've worked at bike shops since I was 13 years old as a mechanic, and I used to race cross country professionally. And so I've always been in this culture and around people who are taking on these routes and who are racing Tour Divide in my personal life. Almost all of them know how to be safe. They know they're in grizzly country on the northern part of this route, and they know they're in black bear country for almost the whole thing. But just like everything else with this bike route, with the race, with bike packing in general, all the education happens completely individually and mostly online. It's a word of mouth thing, so to speak, in Facebook groups. I'll write alongside like trail conditions and fun stories from the trail. And hey, here's a place that I found that will let us do our laundry for free. You know, it's alongside all of those things is, hey, we spotted a grizzly here with cubs yesterday at 5 p.m. And here's the coordinates, or here's exactly where we were when we saw it. Here's a picture. You know, hey, we saw a sign when we were entering this trail outside of Fernie, British Columbia that said, there's a grizzly with cubs that's been spotted here. Be careful, or don't go down this trail. So that's where a lot of this education takes place. And so one rider who's actually on the route right now reached out to me on Facebook, and he told me that he educated himself a lot before he started this ride, but there was a big caveat. And this is exactly what he wrote. I'd like to read it. He said, I actively sought information before leaving home about traveling in grizzly country. I educated myself. But if I had little to no idea before leaving home, I would not have found much besides rudimentary signage at best. It was only when I stayed at Jackson Lake and was leaving the Tetons that I saw any real info. This was through volunteers with the National Park Service who had a display on the side of the road. Grizz education needs to be much more assertive on both sides of the border. And in the course of reporting the story, riders I talked to, they varied a lot on whether the signage throughout grizzly country was adequate. Some thought that it was more than enough, but they all agreed that the only forms of education out there are the signs along the way and however much education an individual chooses on their own to get beforehand. And for that to happen, they have to know they have to get educated.
Right.
The other thing that can help people is, luckily, the maps that Adventure Cycling Association provides, those maps do include some language that warn people about grizzlies, and they offer some tips about how to stay safe.
So it could be tough to educate the riders who don't hit the trail already knowing about bear safety, and as a result, tough to implement, you know, the recommendations by this report, right?
I think it could be a challenge to reach people because, again, there's not any sort of central organization to go to and say, hey, push this out to your bike packers. The report's advice on what backcountry travelers should do, it'll be interesting to see how much that gets picked up. So Matthew Lee, the guy who sets the date and provides tracking for Tour Divide, he told me that the race, in his words, belongs to the community. And we talked on the phone for like 45 minutes about this the other day. And he said that he cares a lot about everybody's safety, but he can't be responsible for everybody out on the trail. Even if he wanted to be, he can't. He's in North Carolina. There's 150 people racing through the wilderness with a little flashing dot of a GPS tracker. So there's no safety net here for people. They're on their own. He said he's he said he's even thinking about, you know, when people sign up on his website to say, hey, track me in Tour Divide this year, putting a little frequently asked questions section. And it might include information about, hey, you need to get educated on grizzlies. But he stressed that even then it would have what he called a preface of, you're on your own, you're on your own. Oh, and by the way, you are on your own.
Right, right. Rob, perhaps you could provide some context on where this particular mauling lands in the ongoing conversation about grizzly bear management in the West.
This is a unfortunately timed incident for grizzly management and grizzly relations, if you want to call it that, for people who just want to be in the backcountry, be in wild parts of the world, and don't have a badge on their chest or a political seat of power, because it points up the very, very different ways that people see grizzly bears. A biologist sees it as a keystone species that has a huge role in how a ecosystem functions. A politician sees it as a thing that can rally people into a room and raise a whole bunch of money either to save it or to kill it, depending on which room you're in and which ideology or political position you want to push for. And then there's the rest of us who just want to, you know, have some time in the summer and see wild animals and nature at work. And you try to figure out, what is the bear to you? Is the bear the highlight of your experience and your trip? Oh my God, I saw 399, the greatest grizzly mother in the world, right there on the side of the road. Or, oh my God, it ripped a woman out of a tent and killed her in the middle of the night. And that is my absolute nightmare and why I'm never getting off the sidewalk again. So to have a big melodramatic, tragic incident like this that everybody then tries to explain and fit into their what do I do this summer perspective. I guess the upside of that is it makes us all think a little harder about where our position is with bears and what do we think our relationship with nature is. Are we in control of it? And this was, the volume was up too loud and we need to turn it down by maybe turning down the number of bears, or boy, we're not in control here. And we need to accept the fact that when we go out, we raise our level of risk the same way that when a golfer goes out in a lightning storm, they might get hit by lightning because they're waving a metal stick in the air. And what really is unfortunate is how politicized it becomes, where you've got people who in the governor's seats of Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho right now are all pushing very strongly to remove grizzly bears from federal protection and allow their state wildlife management agencies to have direct control over their numbers. And all three of them have said, we intend to do this by reinstating grizzly hunts. Despite the fact that there is pretty much no evidence that hunting grizzlies as a big game animal is going to have any real impact on public safety or livestock depredations, other than essentially wiping the bear back off the map the way that we did 50 years ago when we had to put it on the endangered species list. Those three states are all moving in that direction in their state houses at a time when the rest of the nation and even the large majorities of the people in those states think that grizzly bears are a great thing to have on the landscape.
Right.
And one of the things that we all need to remember is that in the United States, by law and tradition, wildlife are what are known as a public trust animal. They belong to everybody. And to have it assumed that they are the purview of some particular interest group or some particular geographic political boundary jurisdiction is just false on the start. Everybody gets a say in how these things are managed, and everybody is gonna have a say if somebody pushes too hard and too far one way or the other.
You know, Rob, we all know, or a lot of us know about, you know, the Night of the Grizzlies and some of the high profile fatal bear maulings of over 50 years ago at this point. And bear managers, there was a lot to learn back then about what we were doing and how it was affecting bear behavior. And there was a lot of naivety at the time that led to, you know, these bear conflicts. And since then we've learned a lot. But are we to a point where now bears have recovered to the point where they're kind of everywhere, and, you know, we've learned so much about how to properly live with them, and yet we still have these sorts of conflicts? Is having fatal bear maulings every couple years just a fact of life in the West? Is there anything more we can learn and any better ways that we can handle ourselves to prevent these from happening?
That's a really good question. One of the things that we have learned over a little more than a century of manipulating bear populations is how very sensitive and fragile the bear is on the ecosystem. Mm-hmm. You know, we are crediting ourselves with recovering the grizzly after almost 50 years of putting it on the endangered species list. And by recovering, that means that we have now got about 2,000 grizzly bears on the landscape south of the Canadian border.
Right.
That's up from somewhere between 400 and 600 over 50 years. And that's up or from a starting point before we started a pretty much organized and federally and state funded pogrom against grizzly bears in the starting about the 1870s and especially ramping up in the 1930s and 40s. We had about 50,000 grizzly bears just between the Canadian and Mexican borders. And yes, they were all the way down and into Mexico. That was a continental species. So we started fiddling around with them, both getting rid of them and preserving them. This is kind of fascinating in the record. We started putting out poison all over the West with federal agents to get rid of bears and wolves and mountain lions that were eating people's cows and sheep. At the same time, we created Yellowstone National Park, and there are actual records from the 1890s where they talk about leaving trash out for the bears.
Right.
And they actively went after and killed all of the wolves and the mountain lions, but actively preserved the bears because people wanted to see them. And Yogi Bear and Picnic Baskets and all of that business became a part of the national, this is what wildlife is like, is these cute fuzzy teddy bears running around that you can see in national parks.
Raining garbage.
And we created, dumps with bleachers and spotlights. And what you did in Yellowstone and Glacier in the evening after dinner was you'd all troop out in your evening clothes and sit on the bleachers and watch the bears come in for the feeding time. So, and then we got upset when we realized that this wasn't the way that you ought to be managing an ecosystem. And we shut all the dumps down in the space of a summer. Mm-hmm. And all of these bears that had become highly habituated to this as a food source suddenly had the buffet table taken away. And that's how you wound up with two severely undernourished and habituated bears killing two women in two different places on the same night in what was became known as the Night of the Grizzlies in 1967. And then we went on this rampage of having bear conflicts over the next couple of years that radically, by the hundreds, lowered what few bears we had left south of the Canadian border, to the point that we had that 400 to 600 number. And in 1975, we put them on the endangered species list. Well, now we have cranked the number back up to about 2,000. But again, we got to remember that this is the slowest reproducing animal, reproducing mammal in North America. It's not like wolves, where you can take 30% of the wolf population out every year and it will bounce back. You take 30% of the bear population out in 1 year because you have an overzealous hunting activity, or we have some sort of a climate-driven change where all of the huckleberry crops fail or something like that. You might lose the bear.
Right.
It could just go. And my confidence in human ability to handle this thing like knobs on a zoo climate air conditioning system is minimal at best. So the idea that we can just grab levers and crank them up and crank them down to serve our needs, I think, is foolish and is bloodthirsty or unsympathetic as it sounds. To get back to your original question, yes, I think we just need to start assuming that people are going to die in the woods because that's where dangerous things happen. And right. If you don't want dangerous things to happen there, stay home with your street gangs and your runaway drunk drivers.
Right. So, I'd be remiss to not mention all of the work that was put into the Grizzly and Us series that Lee Montana newspapers published earlier this year. Rob, could you give us a synopsis of that and tell listeners what went into that and what sort of reporting's there? And maybe update us if any of the reporting from that has changed since then?
In shameless self-promotion, I am really proud of the collection of reporters that put that together and the way that we leveraged our geographic reach with the Missoulian, mm-hmm. the Billings Gazette, the papers in Wyoming, the Helena Independent Record, and Butte. I mean, we are well played out across the major portion of grizzly country. Mm-hmm. And those reporters went through all of their different industries, their different user groups, their different stakeholders. We talked to ranchers, we talked to bikers, we talked to rangers, we talked to biologists, we talked to politicians, we talked to Native American tribes, which, by the way, is an entirely separate issue that you need to get your head around when you're dealing with grizzly bears. Because Native American tribes, as we pointed out in Grizzlies and Us, have a sovereign jurisdiction over their reservation territories, which in many cases happen to be prime grizzly country. I'm especially thinking of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes on the Flathead right. Reservation, the Blackfeet tribe on the Blackfeet Reservation, and the tribes in the Wind Rivers down in Wyoming. Those are prime areas for grizzly bear recovery and grizzly bear outgrowth, and the tribes there have a deep and legal connection to maintaining grizzlies on their landscape that is totally separate from the Endangered Species Act or any state government edict on whether or not we're going to hunt bears or not. So hold that box inside. Grizzlies and us covered all of that fairly extensively. The only thing that I wish that we could have done is we could have kept doing it, because no sooner had we pretty much put the whole thing in the paper and then moved on. As I said before, all three of the state governors then announced that they all wanted it officially removed from the endangered species list. And so now this fight is moving into a very political arena, and we're going to need to circle back to that because one of the biggest changes that we had between when that published and now is the change of administration from the Trump to the Biden leadership, and a very different change of leadership in the Department of Interior from David Bernhard to Deb Haaland. The Interior Department oversees the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which oversees the Endangered Species Act. And what the leadership in there prioritizes or deprioritizes has an awful lot to do with how fast a federally protected animal either stays protected or changes its status. So what I'm seeing right now out of Washington is a very low priority on grizzly. They are slow walking any decision right, left, or sideways because they got lots bigger fish to fry. That's probably going to be a good thing for grizzly bears in terms of their being able to do what they want to do, because we're just not going to be changing the rules on them very fast.
Right.
But the three governors in Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming are doing everything they can to change the temperature of that debate and push it up into people's windshields. And we're going to need to watch for that.
So I guess just to make clear for folks, what powers do those three state governors have in changing grizzly bear policy? You know, it's still an endangered species. It falls under the feds at that point. And where are, I know you kind of said that the feds are kind of just hanging out and not really doing much. Is there a sense that, I guess my first question is, what can the state governors do? And my follow-up question on that is there any sense that that can shift the needle with federal management, with, you know, administrations, you know, federal administrations on the Democratic side and state level governors on the Republican side?
There's two different kind of planes that's working on. On the actual in the dirt where the bear is level of things, bear management is very much a hand in glove relationship between the federal wildlife biologist at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and their counterparts at the state level, like the Montana Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, in the last legislative session in Montana, the legislature passed a law breaking the relationship in a very significant way for handling grizzly conflict. Before that point, the federal Fish and Wildlife Service had contracted with the state Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks that the state guys would set up the culvert traps, catch the bear, and deal with it. And by that, I mean either relocate it into some place far away from the chicken coop, or if it was determined to be too much of a habituated animal, they would kill it on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
The new law does not allow the state people to relocate a bear anymore. So on a purely practical logistical matter, they will still set up the trap, catch the bear, but if it's determined that it's not a bear that needs to be killed in the trap right there, they can't haul the trap to a new place and let it go. They have to get a federal person to come in, drive over for however far it is, and haul it away. So that just kind of throws sand in the gears of day-to-day grizzly bear management. And that's the kind of thing that state governments can do. What they cannot do is take away the federal protections. Right. They can say, we'd like to have a grizzly bear hunt. We'd like to make it a big game animal. But they can't do that until the federal government says, okay, we are taking endangered species protection off the bear. What they can do is ramp up pressure. And this is a very interesting part of American political governance, is small states like Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming have asymmetrical political power, especially in the Senate and Congress. We have all put together about 6 million people in those three states.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an overestimate, actually. I think it's closer to 4 million. But we have six senators. California has 60 million people and two senators.
Right.
So our 4 million folks and six senators outrank California and New York, where, you know, something like 30% of the entire nation lives.
Right.
If we put that political power to a certain direction, we can make big changes. And that's how wolves got taken off the endangered species list, because one senator from one of those states, specifically John Tester from Montana, inserted a rider saying the wolf will be taken off of the endangered species list and you can't take this issue back to court. So nobody could argue that that was illegal or biologically inappropriate, because the law said you can't go to court on it. And wolves all of a sudden became a big game species in those three states. And we've seen the results of how effective we've been able to manage them, and how you can or can't keep wolves that people are paying millions of dollars to come see in Yellowstone Park from getting shot by people who are paying tens of thousands of dollars to get a wolf rug for their hunting trophy. So there is the possibility, if you see a big change in Congress, that that kind of thing could happen at the congressional level.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, at the lower state level, you're seeing this kind of day-to-day logistical bear management dispute.
All right. Well, I guess, you know, one thing's for certain is that, you know, bears are here in the West, and for the time being, they're not going anywhere. And there's still a lot happening on the policy side and on the political side, and frankly, on, you know, the day-to-day life of living in the West, whether you're doing it for fun or whether you're trying to eke out a living here. Bears are certainly a part of the conversation and will be for the time being. Thanks for your time, guys. It's always fun to chat about bears, and unfortunate under these circumstances that there was a fatality involved. But yeah, thanks, guys. Montana Untamed is a podcast from the newsrooms of Lee Enterprises Montana Newspapers. Visit any of our websites or subscribe wherever podcasts are found.